Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of True Crime on Easy Street. My name is Kelly Turner, and I'm not a doctor.
Scott Wright, mediocre journalist.
Katie Givens, not a lawyer.
Hey, guys, congratulations to you both.
What did we do?
So we received an email from a feed spot.
Yep.
Saying that we were voted the number one true crime podcast in the state of Alabama. So, yay!
And apparently it is legitimate. It's not made up.
It's not made up.
And we're not
making it up. It's not something that you buy, like an award for yourself or something.
So yeah, you can do that.
We get nothing from
that. Do we have any money? Could we do that?
No. We literally got an email from the website, and they literally said, we're giving you a virtual high five.
Yep.
So that's what we got for this.
My first ever virtual high five.
I'll take it.
Hey, yeah. I don't care. I don't care who wants to tell us we're number one. Yeah.
We would have taken third place, and we will certainly take first place.
Absolutely.
We would have taken 33rd place.
There was also some pretty cool podcasts on the list that I kind of want to listen to.
I want to reach out too. Yeah, I want to reach out to some of those. And I mentioned this to Kelly, and maybe see if they will cross promote with us.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah,
so
I love it.
We mention them, they mention us. And
yeah. You know. So if you go to our social media sites, you can go to Facebook and Instagram, and you can find the link is on Instagram.
Yeah, you can go and watch us.
Yeah, the link's on Facebook
horn.
Too.
Yeah, we're pretty braggadocious for about a day about that. So then back to work.
Yeah, now it's just it's over. It's mundane now. It's old news.
Yeah, because we're a week out of it, or a week and a half.
Yeah.
We're recording early because I have things to do in
previous
my life.
Engagements.
Yeah, I do.
Today. And speaking of Facebook, Katie, didn't we have some response
to that?
Yes,
to that.
we had a good bit of response to it. One of them we're going to give a shout out to, Pam Dobbins Barth.
Thank you.
We appreciate your comments.
She said it's her favorite podcast.
Oh, thanks, Pam.
So she had already found us.
We appreciate that.
And that's shout outs. That's what we do for people who have found the show. Now, I want to suggest that we create a new category that we do occasionally on the show. We're going to call it a shout down. It's people who don't listen to the show. And we're going to shame them publicly.
Let's do that.
First and foremost.
Do we not already do that?
We do, but now it's official. And first and foremost is, of course, our benefactor, Shane Givens, who is the number one asshole non-listener.
Wank,
shout
wank.
Down. And number two is enemy of the show.
Oh.
Jake Powell.
Wow.
Oh.
Enemy of
we
the
have
show.
An enemy.
So shout down to Jake Powell.
Yeah,
here's what happened.
Jake.
Celeste Lambert, who is a friend of the show.
Yes.
Yeah.
She and Jake were in the car together on the way down to Florida a couple of weeks ago. Celeste suggested listening to the podcast on the way down, and Jake absolutely refused.
Did he say why?
He said it would put him to sleep.
Thanks, Jake.
So kiss our ass, Jake Powell. Yeah. Shout down to you, sir.
Celeste
said she was
going to
let him know.
Show.
I was telling Celeste about this idea yesterday, and she said, I will let him know when you guys do this on the show. So word will get back to him. We may end up with a fan yet.
It's always fun to joke with Jake Powell.
Yes,
so
it is.
He's a good sport.
He is. Anyway,
all right.
That's all.
So I have a shout out.
Okay.
Got a shout out during a Zoom business meeting. Dr. Scott Beatty. He is a doctor.
That name sounds familiar.
He is from, he works at Tulane. So we're in my other life, we do a collaboration.
Yeah.
And so he talked to the group and said he had been listening to our podcast. He was enjoying it. Yeah. Oh. So he travels a lot from New Orleans back to Alabama. He has a home in Alabama and a home in
Did he
New
find
Orleans.
It by accident, or had you mentioned it to him previously?
Scott's husband works with me.
Okay.
And so he found out through Brian. So shout out to Brian Hobson. And they're a really good friend is Deke that I'm always talking about.
Oh yeah.
And so they are really big supporters of the show. So thank you guys so much.
Yes,
appreciate
thank you guys.
It.
Plenty of good shout outs today.
Yep.
You guys want to talk about the karaoke Star Search event.
Quickly, yeah.
That was at Easy Street.
It was a great.
And the reason
I say quickly is because I know we get feedback about talking too much at the
event. I don't give a crap about that. They can start their own podcast if they don't like the way we do ours.
All right, so, okay.
Wait,
so,
do we need to cut that? Did I sound like a jackass?
No, you didn't. You were great. Look, we're apparently very self-important today.
Yeah. We certainly are.
We're apparently sitting on our thrones looking down at everyone. The karaoke, I went and watched the first, there was two rounds of everybody singing. So Nate and I were there to watch. We saw the first round and we were very shocked. We weren't prepared to go into a karaoke competition and people be as good as they were.
Yeah.
It was a great evening. And, there's actually three friends of the show were judges.
Yes.
That's right.
You want to talk about?
So Charlie Freeman, who is in the Shane Gibbons band.
Yeah, so four.
But he was there.
Charlie, yeah.
And then we had Jeannie Hatmaker.
Who's been on our show. Yep.
Stephanie West.
Yes.
And her husband, Travis.
Shorty.
West. Shorty is out there. He's a big fan of the show. And I told Shorty before the show, I said, you're going to be the butt of my jokes tonight. Because I hosted the thing from the stage. And so
Scott was the host.
I'm introducing the judges and running down their qualifications. And I get to Travis and I flip my card back and forth like my notes are missing. And he doesn't have any qualifications. We don't know why he's one of the judges, but we're glad to have him anyway. And he did a great job. They all got a chance to give comments, feedback to the contestants after they performed. Mm-hmm. Travis, you would not know that he was completely unqualified to do that job. He sounded terrific.
He was great. Yeah. All of them gave such good feedback, and you could tell that they were taking it seriously. They were watching.
Yes.
They were paying. They were giving good, constructive criticism where it was needed. But it was good things. Yeah. It was like, "Oh, we want to see you smile more," or it wasn't like Simon Cowell.
Jeannie said that someone. Well, it's funny you said that. Jeannie said that someone accused her of being the Simon Cowell of the judges panel. Yes, she was.
You know what? I think
she was
Jeannie
aghast.
Was the
she
Simon
was,
Cowell.
If anybody was,
if anybody was,
she. I mean, she was the most. I won't. Critical is not the right word.
No,
but just the most. I would like to see you do this, and I loved how you did that, and do this next time.
I took it as more coaching.
Yeah, yes. Coaching. That's right. That's right.
But if there was a Simon Cowell.
It was Jeannie.
It was Jeannie.
Yeah. And somebody apparently told her that after the show.
Oh, I thought she did great, though.
I did, too. Yeah, I thought they all did terrific.
She did great. Yeah. So congratulations to the winners. Does anybody want to give the winners a shout out?
Oh, yes. We had Briley.
Briley Wooden was first place.
No, Briley Meyer.
Meyer. I'm sorry. Briley Meyer. There was somebody whose last name was
Wooden.
Yes, there was.
The show.
Sorry.
Keisha Wooden.
Yeah. Okay.
But, yes, she was... Great too. Yes, Briley Meyer and then Cody Daniel came in second.
First and second. Right. And they're gonna continue that at Easy Street.
Yep.
Quarterly. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the year, there's gonna be the big year end contest. All of those people will qualify and move on. Mm-hmm. You will play in front of the Shane Gibbons band. So you'll have a live band.
Live band.
And the winner gets $1,000. So check the Facebook page for Easy Street, and we'll list it as well on our Facebook page, and we'll let you know so you can come out and see some of these terrific performers. And then when they schedule the final, we'll let you know about that as well.
Sounds great.
And as long as I'm hosting, we're going to get a free plug for the True Crime on Easy Street every time. So
always.
Everybody wins.
Yeah. Everybody. So. Yeah. And be sure if you venture to Easy Street during the week, first of all, do that. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun. But try out bingo on Tuesdays.
Yep.
Wednesday is trivia.
Live trivia.
And then Thursday is...
they're going to do the karaoke, I think.
Every other Thursday.
So check the billboard or check the website and figure out your bet. And then if you follow them on Facebook, you can see the special for the weekend or the evening. Last night I noticed that for Saturday night, the Sliders were back and I was like, dang it. I was there on Friday night.
I guess he's not enemy of the show, but thumbs. What'd you say?
Enemy of the show, Jake Powell.
Yeah.
Well, no, but
shout down
Shane shout Gibbons. Down. He spends a lot of time putting all that stuff on Facebook.
That
so that if you have any question on what's happening at Easy Street.
You
should find it on Facebook because
follow them on Facebook.
It's a labor of love to keep that updated.
It is.
I only have to do it 2 days a week. I do a little on Tuesday and a little on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. I couldn't imagine having to keep up with all of that all day, every day, and run a restaurant on top of everything else. So, yep. I mean, if that was your only job, I mean, they need a PR person.
I'm honestly like a social media manager, really, if we could afford one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it is. It's a lot
they
of work.
They can't afford it because they're too busy supporting our podcast. So, oh, well.
Yeah. You know. We are a drain on the operation. Financially and emotionally.
Oh, man.
Exactly. All right. So, thanks to everybody for listening and supporting us. And we love you.
Yeah,
we appreciate it.
We're just really trying to drag it out now, aren't we? Let's keep talking about something else. I was just wrapping it up
so that we can move on. So are you ready, Scott?
Sure.
Scott is in the big chair today, and you've seen the title of the show.
Yep. You guys ever been to Boston?
I've never been to Boston.
No?
Never been.
All right, quick story about Boston. I've been three times.
I've also never been to Spain, but I kind of like the music.
I don't know how we got to Spain.
Is that a reference? That
it's a song. It's lyrics. Sorry.
I get it.
That's, who's it?
Who does sing?
Who sings Joy to the World? Three Dog Night. Sorry.
Wow. Yeah,
sorry. And
that's just a little hint of what you get on Wednesday night at trivia.
Wish I would have got it. I'm feeling like it's good.
I've actually been on an airplane with the members of Three Dog Night.
Did they sing I've Never Been to Spain?
No, I never even saw them. Somebody just said, hey, that's Three Dog Night as we were getting off the plane. Mm. Jeremiah Was a Bullfrog.
They have some great music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this has been a long time ago. Okay. It may have been one of these trips to Boston. So I've been to Boston three times.
Okay.
96, 06, and 16. Not on purpose, 10 years apart.
Seriously?
Wow. Yes. Okay.
But every time I went, you would go to Cheers, you know, the Bull and Finch pub there on Beacon Street.
Yeah.
And you get your picture made in front of the sign that says Cheers.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so in 96... I get my picture made. I go back in 2006, get my picture made at the same spot. I get home and get to looking. I'm wearing the same fucking shirt in both pictures. Not on purpose.
Of course you are.
Not on purpose. I'm wearing the same shirt.
Great.
It's like an orange Henley. It's the ugliest. I never wore it anywhere else. I just always kept it in my suitcase because it was a good shirt to travel with.
Wait a minute. This shirt just lived in your suitcase.
Pretty much. Because it was ratty and it was just something that you can wear on a trip, and you've got sleeves, so if it's a little cold in the morning.
You talk like you don't have a job.
I'm laughing. It was my lucky noise.
It was my lucky travel shirt.
What the heck? Are you talking about?
It's worked every time so far. I've made it home every time.
What size shirt do you wear?
Large.
I mean, all right, let's.
Everybody get Scott a new shirt.
His birthday is this week.
He can't even.
That's right.
Is your birthday the day this comes out?
It's the 20th. Yeah, I believe that's today, right?
Yeah. Yep,
today. Happy birthday, Scott.
39 again.
Yeah, since got a shirt size large.
Yeah, he needs a birthday shirt.
Anyway.
Apparently, because he just has to keep that one ratty one in his suitcase all the time.
It's still around the house somewhere.
And he wears it everywhere, and people think, oh my gosh.
This one shirt, Scott.
Somebody help this guy out.
I know you've bought Shane a t-shirt before. You need to get yourself another one.
You've swapped t-shirts with some random dude in a bathroom.
How do you know that story?
Everyone knows that story.
You told the story.
That story.
Why didn't you just find some dude and swap that orange shirt?
If I had known I was taking the picture with the same photo.
Because no one would swap.
It's a pretty ugly shirt.
Okay.
It's not good.
I'm sorry.
Anyway, so one of the things that you do is you go to the Bull and Finch pub where Cheers is filmed.
Yes.
And I would always go, for me, it was a trip to go to Fenway Park.
Okay.
Okay.
Not because I'm a Red Sox fan. It's just if you're going to go see a baseball team, it's the coolest stadium in the majors, the oldest stadium in the majors, opened in 1912. You got to go see a Red Sox game in Fenway.
Oh, yeah.
At some point in your
life. Absolutely.
Okay, so obviously we're going to be talking about Boston today, if we haven't given it away already, and you forgot to read the title of the episode. I learned a lot of interesting facts about Boston, things I didn't know a good bit of it, and about the Boston Marathon in particular. And a lot of that information comes from the Boston Athletic Association website, which was created back in the 1800s, and they're the group that puts on the Boston Marathon every year.
Okay.
So just a few quick facts about the history of the Boston Marathon. The first Boston Marathon was run in 1897. 15 participants in the first one. Significantly more these days.
Yeah.
A man named J.J. McDermott of New York won the first marathon in 2 hours and 55 minutes. And this doesn't really have anything to do with anything, but I was reading this information. I've got to tell you guys who won the second Boston Marathon.
Okay.
The second year, 1898, it was the first time they'd ever had a foreign champion. He was from Nova Scotia, He was a student at Boston University. I'm sorry, Boston College. His name, Ronald McDonald.
I love it.
So,
congratulations.
Nothing Ronald. To do with anything. initially, in 1897, when the Boston Marathon began, it was not 26.2 miles, which is the standard distance for a marathon. Mm-hmm. They changed the distance in 1924 to the 26.2 miles so that it's the same distance as the marathon that is run in the Olympics. So I guess people could train.
So what was it originally?
24.8 miles originally.
Why did that just line up better with the city blocks?
No, that was the distance that supposedly, and I forget the Greek story or ancient story about the runner who made it.
To marathon, right? Isn't that why it's called a marathon?
He was running to marathon in Greece to deliver information that their armies had won a battle, and he collapsed and died famously after running the 24.8 miles. And there's something to do with the King and Queen of England about why the distance is what it is. Like, they wanted to be able to sit and see the thing start and finish in the same place, and it worked out to be 26.2 miles.
Okay.
I think I got that right. Maybe not. But I said it with confidence.
But I bet they didn't say miles in England, though.
It's no.
Kilometers.
Yeah. Well, maybe back then it was still miles. I don't know. Now you've got me in an area where I have absolutely no idea what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Thanks.
You're welcome. That's what I'm here for.
There are as many as 30,000 participants in the Boston Marathon, and 500,000 people take part in the crowd that gathers around to watch. This year's event, next month in April, will be the 128th running of the Boston Marathon.
Wow.
The one that we're talking about that took place in 2013 was the 117th running of the marathon, and there were 26,900 runners in it that year.
It's insane to me that there's that many people who can run a marathon.
Yeah. So imagine this. Imagine every single person in Cherokee County running down the street. That's how many people.
Wow.
That's a funny thought.
That's how many people run in the Boston Marathon every year.
That's a good illustration.
Yeah, and that would be every person in Cherokee County on 4th of July weekend when we're crowded with tourists.
Holy moly.
Right?
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah.
We are very crowded. I can't believe that we've become a tourist destination, but hey, that's...
It's been in the works for a long time and sponsored the show, the Chamber.
The Chamber has worked hard on it.
Yes, they have.
Yeah, here we go.
Teresa Hogan for a long time. Directed the Chamber. Now Joy Perry is the director.
Yeah.
But they have really been big on that. And, you know, there's been some development. Chestnut Bay is open now, and they finally, after decades, got Cherokee Rock Village and turned it into a tourist attraction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for a long time, it was just where you snuck up on the weekends and built a campfire and drank beer if you were an underage teenager.
Yeah.
That was for a long time. That's all that it was.
Just telling on everybody.
Yeah.
Well, it's over now.
Once you rat everybody out, Scott, you narc. All right. So, yeah. So, everybody here on 4th of July weekend just takes off running down the street.
Yeah. If you're from here, you don't go to Walmart that weekend.
No, do not go to Walmart that weekend.
You really don't.
That's the most dangerous intersection in the county. The Boston Marathon is run on the third Monday in April. That is known as Patriots Day in Massachusetts. Okay. It's a state holiday that commemorates the beginning of the Revolutionary War, the battles at Lexington and Concord. You know, Paul Revere, that whole thing.
Yeah, I didn't realize that.
I didn't either. And those battles actually took place on April the 19th, 1775. And for a long time, the marathon was run on April the 19th, no matter what day it fell on.
Okay.
Ooh, then that became a problem.
That became a scheduling problem at one point. So in 1969, the state legislature declared that the third Monday in April would always be celebrated as Patriots Day.
Okay.
I forgot where we got to. We just did some editing and I forgot what happened. So what I was telling you guys is, just leave it in. Screw it. Let them hear how the sausage is made for once. Another reason for the scheduling change was because Major League Baseball always gives the Boston Red Sox a home game on that day. And so the game always starts at 11 o'clock in the morning so that the crowd can get out in time to join the crowd on Boylston Street where the finish line is for the Boston
Marathon.
That is
a busy day in Boston. Yeah.
Very busy day in Boston.
Wait, there's a baseball game, and then the marathon, like, do they start at the same time?
The marathon starts about 9 o'clock in the morning. Okay. So,
but they're wanting people to be done with the ball game to
get out and join the crowd.
And join the crowd.
It's about 500,000 people, they say.
Oh, well, they have to stagger start the marathon. So not everyone starts at 9. Yeah. Okay, I forget about that.
Yeah, I'm going to give you, in just a second, I'll tell you how they actually start the marathon. Okay. Who goes when. Now, Before we get the marathon started, I decided that I would do a set the table segment today. You guys know how I like to do that. But we're not going to do 2013, the year of the marathon, or the Boston Marathon in question. We're going to go back to 1897.
The first year.
The first year of the Boston Marathon. So on January the 22nd, 1897, the journal Engineering used the word computer for the very first time in print to describe a mechanical calculation device.
Okay.
I didn't know that. And here's one for Katie, possibly. The next day, a woman named Elva Heaster, the very next day, January the 23rd, 1897, she was found dead in Greenwich County, West Virginia. The resulting murder trial of her husband is the only documented instance ever where a conviction was secured using spectral evidence at the trial.
Yeah, I don't know what eyewitness? That is.
Spectral evidence is defined as a form of legal evidence based upon the testimony of someone who claims to have experienced a vision.
Oh.
Oh, Lord. So not an eyewitness.
I don't know anything else about...
Eyewitness testimony is terrible enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just imagine if you can get somebody to submit your vision as evidence.
Oh.
And I don't know anything else about Elva Heaster's husband or the trial.
We might need to put that on the list for October.
But I'm thinking we give it to Katie because she is increasingly becoming the person who does the quirky stuff. That's her wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. And I love that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Katie Elva Heaster.
Okay.
And her spectral evidence.
Table that for later in the year.
The following month, like we mentioned, on the same day, the Boston Marathon was run for the first time on April the 19th back then. On that very same shit. I shouldn't have had that second cup of coffee.
It makes you cough?
Yeah.
I think the mic makes you cough.
Maybe it does. The following day, on the same day that the Boston Marathon was run, workers struck oil on the Osage Indian Reservation in Oklahoma, eventually leading to the story that Martin Scorsese has told on the big screen and that we told last year in season 3, episode 44, The Killers of the Flower Moon. Mm-hmm. I have to take a deep breath on this one because this is a mouthful. I'm going to screw it up the first time.
All right.
In August of 1897 at Bayer Pharmaceutical, acetylsalicylic acid
was successfully
synthesized for the first time.
Okay.
And the company marketed the resulting pain-relieving product under the brand name Aspirin.
All right.
And finally, back in Boston, the first underground public transportation system in the United States opened in 1897. The 1/3 mile Tremont Line is part of the Green Line today. I mean, you guys don't know what the hell I'm talking about because you've never been to Boston.
No.
But if you go to Boston, you ride the subway.
Yeah, definitely.
It's, you know,
I would think so.
Yeah.
Most big cities, that's what you do. That's the best way
to travel.
But
that's crazy. So the first... was in Boston, not New York.
That's right.
How about that?
And it's still here today. It's still in use. Those original tunnels that they built.
Well, I mean.
Nice job, Boston.
127 years ago.
That was a great idea.
Mm-hmm. Make a trip.
And so now we will get to the story, finally. Okay. So your husband, Kevin, can, if he has skipped ahead. Katie marked the time and we'll tell him where to skip ahead to if he wants to miss all the other stuff. The 117th running of the Boston Marathon took place on April the 15th, 2013. That Monday morning was a sunny day in Boston and the surrounding suburbs and towns with temperatures in the mid-40s at the beginning of the marathon and highs expected to reach the mid-50s. Beautiful day. And I mentioned the surrounding towns and suburbs because the marathon does not begin in Boston. It's not run around and around and around in Boston. It begins 25 miles away in a town called Hopkinton.
Okay.
Population 15,000. So their city population quadruples on that day.
Yes.
And then you run on an easterly course because there's nothing east of Boston. Boston is on the shore. So if you want to keep your feet dry, you walk west from Boston.
Okay.
Or in this case, you run east toward Boston.
Got it.
You cross through, when you leave Hopkinton, you go through 6 other towns in Massachusetts before you get to Boston. Mm-hmm. On the day of this story, on the day of our story, the race began as normal, 9 a.m., with the wheelchair division leaving first.
Okay.
And then 20 minutes later, hand cycles left the start line.
Okay.
Followed next by the elite women at 9:30, the elite men at 10 a.m., and then there are several waves of thousands of runners that leave in 20-minute intervals until everybody's gone.
Who were not racing for first.
Correct.
Okay, got it. They're just checking a life goal there.
Yeah, exactly.
Trying to run that.
That's right. And I didn't know this because the course is, it's generally downhill I think you lose about 40 or 50 feet in elevation from the beginning to the end. I forget the exact number. It's not considered difficult enough to be considered for world records.
Oh.
So there's a record for the Boston Marathon that I think is 2 hours and 3 minutes, something like that.
That's trucking it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the world record is about a minute slower. It's set somewhere in Germany. Is where the world record for a marathon is. But you couldn't set a world record at the Boston Marathon because the record books won't accept it.
But we don't care about that.
It's too easy.
Boston doesn't care about that.
They don't care. No.
They're like, screw that.
Too easy and marathon in the same sentence doesn't work for me.
Oxymoron.
If you had that on your bingo card. Mm-hmm. One of the books that I read about the 117th running of the Boston Marathon was written by a man named Greg Kalkwarf. K-A-L-K-W-A-R-F. He was running his very first Boston Marathon. Kalkwarf had been a runner for several years and had taken part in other full marathons around the country, but this was his first time for the big one. And his book is titled, Was That Thunder? More Than a Boston Marathon Bombing Story. It was written in 2018. It's a really good book. I learned a lot about not just the marathon, but the kind of person that it takes to have the desire to compete in an event like the marathon from Greg's book. If you find yourself, did I call him Brian? No, it's Greg, right? I said Greg, didn't I? Did I say Brian?
I don't know.
It's Greg.
Okay.
Greg Kalkwarf. And I reached out to him via email last week. I told Kelly about this. I'm not sure if I told you,
Katie. Told me too.
Okay. He's going to get us, he and I swapped a couple of emails. He's going to send me a couple of quotes about some of his experiences, and we're going to use them next week in part two.
Oh, that's great. Yeah,
very neat. So he is a new friend of the show.
Thank you, Greg.
So shout up. Shout out.
Not
a shout down to Greg Kalkwarf. He had just crossed the finish line in 2013, and he was very tired, a little dehydrated, so he went over to the medical tent, which is always set up right past the finish line. Mm-hmm. And that's when he heard the first bomb go off. And that's why he thought it might be thunder. That's what he said to himself, was that thunder? And that's where he got the title of the book. Now, according to the National Library of Medicine website, 281 people were injured in the bombings. There were two bombs that day. Greg was not one of them, but there were 281 people who were injured. The first bomb exploded at 2:49 p.m. local time, about 55 feet from the finish line. And 12 seconds later, a second bomb went off 180 yards further away from the finish line than the first bomb. Kalkwarf said that he thought maybe a generator exploded. There's a lot of electrical equipment around the finish line. He thought maybe something had blown there. And then he said the mood began to change in the medical tent. Like the word had gotten to the staff, hey, we've got injured people headed towards you right now.
Oh.
And that's when he kind of got the idea. He had to get out of the way because he wasn't injured. He needed some fluids and to get off his feet. He had blisters on his feet from running 26.2 miles.
I can only imagine. Yeah.
One of the things that he said was you had to get to Hopkinton so early that morning. You got there 3 or 4 hours before you actually left the start line.
Yeah. You don't just jump.
So you're
out
on
of
your
the
feet
bed,
the whole time,
put on some clothes and go run a marathon.
It's like a 45 minute bus ride from Boston to Hopkinton.
Well, then you need to stretch. You need to kind of do some warm-ups,
And there's this whole procedure for you can have a bag of stuff that they will take back to the finish line for you. Mm-hmm. And you have a receipt or a card, and then they'll hand you your...
Like a bag valet.
Like maybe your cell phone or, the keys to your apartment, whatever.
Yeah, because you don't whatever want you don't any want to run of that with you while you're running.
Yeah, that's a pain in the ass.
I can't.
The first injured person that Greg saw being wheeled into the medical tent was in a wheelchair, and he thought one of the wheelchair runners, participants had been injured. And then he noticed that the man's foot was missing.
Oh my gosh.
And that his bone was sticking out of his leg where his foot was supposed to be.
Oh no.
And there was blood everywhere. There were 264 critical injuries, and there were 17 of what is known in the field of medicine as traumatic amputation.
Mm.
And Greg had seen one.
How many of those?
17.
17.
Yeah.
A total of 127 people received care at local trauma hospitals in the Boston area, which thankfully Boston has 4 or 5 of, including a pediatric trauma unit. So there's no good place for a bomb to go off. But if you have injured people, traumatically injured people, Boston is as good a place as any to be injured like
they
that.
They had the resources yes. there.
Of the 127 people who received care at trauma hospitals, none of them died.
Oh, that's
And if you really believe in miracles, yeah. that may be one.
Yes.
Because there were some horribly injured people laying on those sidewalks after those bombs went off. Of 75 patients who were admitted to area hospitals, 54 underwent surgery, urgent surgery, for some injury or other. And like I said, 17 traumatic amputations that had to be dealt with. The bombs killed 3 people that day in Boston. And we will tell you the names of those victims and a little bit about each of the 3 of them right after these words from our sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you in part by A&W Outdoor Services, located right here in Cherokee County, Alabama. It's almost time to tidy up the deck, clean the gutters, and spruce up the yard and landscaping around your home, lake house, or creekside cabin. And who better to do that for you than the professional crew at A&W Outdoor Services? Call 256-706-7964 and let Alan and his crew do all the hard work for you so you can spend your time this summer enjoying your piece of Cherokee County in clean, carefree comfort. Call Alan today for a free estimate or to get on the A&W spring schedule before it's full. That's A&W Outdoor Services at 256-706-7964.
Hey guys, do you know what time it is?
Tell us.
It's time to plan your best vacation ever right here in beautiful Cherokee County, Alabama.
Many outdoor adventures await. You can wet a hook in beautiful Weiss Lake, swing away at Cherokee Pines Golf Club, climb to the best year-round at Cherokee Rock Village, hike the Little River Canyon National Preserve, take a days-long splash at Pirates Bay Water Park, and there's so much more.
The Cherokee County Chamber of Commerce and Tourism has a full list of recommended lodging facilities, RV sites, and campgrounds, and they're all set up to suit your vacation needs, whatever they may be.
So come see us from wherever you are located. And if you already live right here in Cherokee County, then plan your summer staycation with the Chamber by visiting cherokee-chamber.org.
Thank you to all of our wonderful sponsors. All right, Scott.
Okay, so I told you a little bit about our new friend Greg Cockworth's book.
Yes.
Another really well-written book to read about this true crime was published in 2020 and was written by an investigative reporter named Michelle McPhee. The title of her book is Mayhem, Unanswered Questions About the Boston Marathon Bombing. The book is very descriptive. It's very well-researched. It's very well-written. And it's very graphic in some places, not to the point of being gratuitous. She's a reporter, like I said, so she's just giving you the facts. And sometimes, sadly, the facts are gruesome.
Yes.
I mean, this is one of the largest domestic terrorism attacks in the United States since, of course,
9/11
and the, don't forget about the Alfred P. Murray building in Oklahoma back in 1995.
Oklahoma City.
And we're gonna cover that story at some point down the road.
Sure, yes.
But this was a giant crime scene. The crime scene was a third of a mile long and 3 blocks wide. So big crime scene. The race was canceled immediately.
Sure.
They got word to the officers stationed all along the route, hey, hold everybody at this street. Mm-hmm. Send them somewhere else. They can't come here. But nobody cared that the race was over. I mean, it's, you know, disappointing if you train for a year to go run the Boston Marathon and
but you're talking about
a half mile from the finish line. You're like, it's over. Go home.
People who are missing.
Sure.
Limbs.
Yeah. Nobody cared about
once
that.
Once they figured that out,
that's right.
You know, I'm sure it was very heartbreaking at first. To, what?
And in the confusion, but when you hear that bombs have gone off and people have passed away.
Exactly. Oh, yes.
I get it.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They closed down the airport. Logan International Airport was shut down for several hours that afternoon. You could not fly over the city of Boston in anything. They grounded all the TV news helicopters.
I mean, seriously, what a nightmare for authorities because there's people everywhere.
Everywhere.
Your crime scene situation is completely.
Well, and think about this. A lot of the hotels in the area were right inside that 3 block area.
Gosh.
And the first thing they did was shut down. They locked down all the hotels. So a lot of these people, suddenly they're caught on the street. They can't even go back up to their hotel room just to get out of the way because they can't go in. That was several hours before they started letting people back into the
hotels.
I totally
get that because they're like trying to quickly discern who did this.
What the hell's going on?
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Cell phone service came and went. obviously this is 2013, so not quite as many, even in a big city like Boston, probably not as many, not as much. What bandwidth is that? Am I saying that the right way? You know, you just, you tied up the phones a lot faster.
It probably, cell phone service probably wasn't good anyway. It, you know, you,
no. Like, yeah. 2013 is, no, that's,
it's you get that many people together.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember
going to. You still have trouble with cell service if you go to a college football game to this day.
That's what I was going to say years ago. I remember going to Talladega Super Speedway two events. And right about the time the race started, everybody's phone died because everybody was taking a picture of the green flag or some event. You know, you could tell when something was going on because all of a sudden you'd lose your phone service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So all these hundreds of thousands of frightened, confused people, a lot of them had bags on their arms. And a lot of them dropped their bags and took off running.
Oh, no.
When all of this happened. So now you've got backpacks and purses littering the street.
And they're thinking,
how many more bombs are there?
Oh, my gosh.
That's what they're thinking.
Oh, what a nightmare.
They had, they've ended up with 61 discarded backpacks on the sidewalk. And so the bomb squads had to go through every one of them.
Every single one of them.
And make sure that it wasn't bomb number three. They even detonated one. It was a backpack, but it was underneath the temporary grandstand that had been set up at the finish line.
I remember
And they detonated it on purpose because they couldn't figure out what was in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody heard three explosions.
Mm-hmm. But
so
it was,
they don't know
but
that
there was only two bombs.
That's right. But if you didn't know what the third bomb was, or the detonation of the suspected bomb, you thought, shit, there's number three.
It's just chaos.
Yeah,
just
chaos.
Total chaos.
So at the scene, you had the Boston Police Department, the FBI, agents from the ATF, the DEA. They're already investigating what they can. As soon as you get the bombs cleared out, everybody's coming in to try and start investigating the crime scene. They're collecting evidence, and there's this massive triage operation going on all around them. Right. All these people are bleeding and dying.
Mm.
And so you know now why Michelle McPhee titled her book Mayhem, because she was there. She was right there. She had been in New York City on September the 11th. Oh. She was the police bureau chief for the New York Daily News, one of the New York papers. And so she was there, and then she was here this day at the Boston Marathon. So she saw two horribly traumatic events in her reporting career.
Oh my gosh.
And among all of that mayhem on and around Boylston Street, all of that screaming and the pools of blood and the severed limbs lying on the sidewalk and the smell of smoke and singed hair and burning flesh and rushing EMTs and tensed up police officers and speeding ambulances and 27,000 runners and nearly 500,000 spectators, somewhere amid all of that fear and uncertainty and confusion and mayhem lay three dead people.
Mm.
Crystal Marie Campbell, age 29, was part of the throng of people that had joined the crowd near the finish line after she left the Boston Red Sox game with her boyfriend and her best friend and her boyfriend. So the four of them together.
Double date.
Right,
yeah.
Double date for the Boston Red Sox game. The game got over at 2:08 p.m. Eastern time, local time, about 40 minutes before the bomb went off, the first bomb. Crystal died alongside her best friend who was holding her hand.
Oh,
and she lost a leg herself, but she survived.
Gosh.
12 seconds after the first blast, the second and much more powerful bomb exploded 180 yards from the first bomb. The second blast produced what McPhee said, she called it in her book, an ugly orange fireball. She saw it.
Oh my gosh.
And it was because it was later determined that both of these bombs were made out of pressure cookers. Like you guys might have in your kitchen.
Mm-hmm. I'm terrified of those
things. Yeah, I don't use Instapot.
Yeah. I got rid of my Instapot because I'm terrified. Yeah. I was terrified of it.
The second bomb, the first bomb was inside the backpack in a way that it exploded straight up. So it was set down in a way that the bottom of the pressure cooker was on the ground.
Okay.
The second bomb was laid on its side, either by accident or on purpose. Mm-hmm. And so it exploded sideways.
Oh.
And so by exploding sideways, there were more things that could be caught on fire, including people.
Yeah. So it exploded sideways towards the running path. Is that that where it, was, it went?
It was right on the sidewalk, at the edge of the sidewalk, beside a tree. Mm-hmm. And there were those temporary metal barricades.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a bunch of kids with their feet in those barricades hanging on to the top and leaning out and high-fiving right. the runners as they came
and
by.
And it exploded in that direction.
In that general direction.
You have to be a child to stand on those. Like, if you're too big, you'll topple them over.
How many of those children were injured?
A lot.
Oh, gosh.
A lot. Lingzi Liu, a 23-year-old Boston University student from China, had her entire body ripped apart by the second blast.
Oh, gosh.
She died in less than a minute. She, too, died with her hand in her best friend's hand.
Oh.
Lingzi Liu was an only child. Had she been allowed by her parents to travel to America to get an education? So she was, except for her friend, she was alone in a strange land, truly. Mm-hmm. 8-year-old Martin Richard had his entire body blasted to bits.
Oh my gosh.
By small nails, round metal pellets, and jagged metal pieces from the disintegrated pressure cooker that contained bomb number 2.
Scott.
Died in his mother's arms.
I am now mad.
Yeah.
I've gone from being like sad to like, who did this?
Full body chills.
You know, this is disgusting.
Mom, his mother lost her eye. Dad lost his hearing. Sister Jane lost her leg. And they all lost 8-year-old Martin right there on the sidewalk. Much like the feeling that we all had on September the 11th, when the second plane hit the World Trade Center, yep. Everybody knew when that second bomb went off that it was a terrorist attack.
Mm-hmm.
The Boston bombing, it would ultimately be discovered, was committed by homegrown jihadists who had immigrated to the United States 11 years before from Eastern Europe in search of a better way of life. But nobody knew that yet. Not yet. It would take 4 more days to find out the names of the 2 young men who bloodied the streets of Boston on Monday, April the 15th, 2013. As Michelle McPhee wrote in her book, and I'm quoting, "Things like this didn't happen in Boston. The amputated limbs of 17 people scattered on the sidewalks alongside the bodies of 2 young women and an 8-year-old boy. This was a scene Americans were only familiar with in footage from suicide bombings in the Middle East. The city on a hill, the birthplace of liberty in America, had never endured such an assault before, and its perpetrators were alive and at large."
Mm.
As I mentioned before, the investigation began almost as soon as the second blast had died down. Businesses were closed for several days. Bartenders, servers, retailers couldn't go back to their jobs in downtown Boston for days. They got the 61 backpacks figured out, sorted. Video footage from hundreds of security systems in the area was quickly secured.
Mm-hmm.
And before long, law enforcement was asking anybody at the airports. They stayed at the airports for a couple of days as people left town. "Hey, were you at the bombing? Can you share your video footage with us?" Eventually, the FBI collected over 70 terabytes of data.
That's a lot.
From the crime scene. Yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot. And speaking of backpacks, it was an early and ultimately accurate theory that the FBI had that the bombs must have been brought in backpacks.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there was one backpack at the scene that was, a lot of the others that they found just might have had shrapnel damage on one spot or the other, but this particular bag was completely disintegrated.
So they knew.
So they were, that's probably where the bomb came from. Investigators commandeered an entire hangar at the nearby Boston cruise ship terminal and set up a temporary lab to view the accumulated data and process all the physical evidence from the crime scene. 2 floors of a nearby hotel were converted to a command post for various investigative agencies working on the crime. And there's a 2016 movie titled Patriots Day that I watched this weekend. It stars Mark Wahlberg, John Goodman, and Kevin Bacon. It's a pretty good movie.
Of course it has Mark Wahlberg in it.
Of course, Marky Mark is in it, right?
I love Mark Wahlberg.
I do too. I like him just fine. I do. He's fun to watch in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
But the portion of the film that deals with the aftermath and the investigative process, I think, is based on accurate information. So it's fun to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the subject matter is not a fun subject, but it's a good movie.
I've not seen this, and I need to watch it.
I hadn't either. I had never seen it before.
I need to do that before part two.
Yeah, it gets generally good reviews. Okay. I think it's 80-something percent on Rotten Tomatoes, but surprise, the people of Boston hate this movie.
Oh, they do? Why? They hate
it. Because Wahlberg's character is sort of an amalgam of experiences that various police, he plays a police officer.
Okay.
And he connects the whole movie together because he moves through the movie, this character, this police officer, and he is the one who is present at every one of these different things that happen over the course of this 4-day investigation and manhunt.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody really was that person. So they were like, you know, there are plenty of actual heroes in this story. Why did you have to make one up?
Oh.
But that's
a valid point.
I know, but that's how movies work.
But it is. It's also a movie that's designed to entertain.
Yes.
And you got to have the hero.
And they've got to, and they can't explain the whole damn movie. They can't explain stuff to you every 20 minutes all through the movie.
What they want is a good documentary about it.
Yeah. And there are a bunch of those as well. Yeah. There's a great 3-part documentary on Netflix right now. There's one on Hulu that I think I will mention next week because I haven't watched it yet.
Do the people of Boston like the documentaries?
I don't know. It was very specific that they
just don't like the movie.
Didn't like what Marky Mark did.
Did they not like Mark Wahlberg, the people of Boston?
I don't know. I why would you not like your favorite son?
Like the darling of your town. I don't know.
There's this expression that I learned that people up in that area of the world use. The typical Boston person always ends up looking like what they call a masshole.
Yeah.
Not an asshole.
I've heard the term masshole.
I'd never heard it before.
But I think.
What does that mean?
Just an asshole from Massachusetts.
Asshole.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
I think, though, that we should be able to understand that because a lot of times the Southerner.
Yeah.
Is stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Always the idiot.
And I have a thick accent. But even like in the movies, they make you know.
Oh my gosh! Some of them even sound like Southern politicians. All very similar to how our governor sounds right now, but even worse, even more cartoonish.
Straight up Foghorn Leghorn.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
And it's like, can't you just talk to someone who lives here?
We don't speak like Gone with the Wind.
Mm-hmm. No.
Yeah,
we do not.
I would say Tara, not Tara.
Yeah.
You know.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm with you.
But Kay Ivey would.
Kay Ivey
would. Governor Kay Ivey, bless her heart, she would. Bless her heart. Okay, so here are the facts. Let's get back to the facts that are not in dispute. Some of the movie may have been fictional, but here's what we know. The FBI took over the investigation that afternoon, and the Boston Police Department was in charge of securing the crime scene.
Okay.
There was a Boston Bruins hockey game that night that was canceled. Every police officer in Boston was called into active duty and they started working 12-hour shifts. There were so many agencies from outside the city that sent officers to investigate and to assist in the investigation that a lot of them had to sleep in their cars in the parking deck at the FBI office in downtown Boston. By Tuesday, the FBI was ready to announce that the bombers, whoever they were, had carried heavy backpacks and that had contained the bombs made out of pressure cookers. And it turns out that the instructions on how to make those bombs was readily available in a Al-Qaeda magazine.
Oh.
And the title of the article was something like, How to Make a Bomb in Your Mom's Kitchen.
Good gracious.
That's where they learned how to make these bombs. We don't know that yet, though. But one of the things that helped, they found a part of one of the pressure cookers on the roof of an 8-story building. And they figured out that it was a particular brand of pressure cooker that was only available in one department store in the entire country, and that was at Macy's. They were the only department store that carried this particular brand. So that helped in the investigation.
Yeah.
Later on Tuesday afternoon, the Boston Celtics canceled a home game. This is the day after. It was Thursday before the FBI released its latest information about the bombing, and they said they knew that they were looking for two young men who had been identified in connection with the blasts. Their photos pulled from still images from video security cameras in the area around the blasts, before the blasts. They kind of worked backwards and figured out there was one guy. Everybody else was looking at the first bomb, and one guy was walking the other way. So that was suspicious. So they put the pictures of these two suspects on big poster boards. They had a televised press conference. And they did it in part because the conspiracy nuts were already working overtime. The tinfoil hat crowd never goes to sleep.
They never rest.
So they were getting, there was a lot of false information that was making its way to the press as legitimate news. So they're like, we've got to have a press conference and get everybody to help us instead of everybody running off like chickens with their heads missing.
Yes.
A rapt nationwide TV audience learned at that press conference that the FBI, two as yet unknown, unnamed men, they were armed and extremely dangerous. No one except law enforcement should attempt to apprehend them. Over and over, they repeated this because they were afraid somebody's going to, you know, go Marshall Dillon. And
yeah, because people were very mad.
Very
angry.
Upset.
Yes.
But the images of the two suspects looked like a thousand other white kids in Boston. T-shirts, jeans, backwards baseball caps. Mm. They could have been almost anyone. So now suddenly every stranger on the street is a potential bomber to the frightened people in the city of Boston. Mm-hmm. Could be that guy could be a terrorist. That guy could be a terrorist. In the images from the Boylston Street videos, the taller of the two suspects wore a black baseball cap. The shorter man's hat was white. And so as of Thursday, April the 18th, the search was underway for black hat and white hat.
And they both, you could tell, couldn't you, that they had dark hair?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could.
Darker hair.
So, but we're still at the point in this investigation when nobody in law enforcement has any idea of exactly who they're looking for. Except possibly, if you believe some people, including investigative reporter Michelle McPhee in her book Mayhem, the Federal Bureau of Investigation knew exactly who they were looking for and had, they had had at least one of them, so the story goes, on their radar for a year and a half.
Why?
I'll tell you next week.
Oh, how dare you, Scott?
And I realize that we have run your frustration level up to 7 on a scale of 1 to 10.
Yes.
And it's going to get even higher next week when we do part 2, when we do the search for Black Hat and White Hat, the two young men responsible for the Boston Marathon bombing next week.
Well, Scott, I cannot wait. I'm very mad at you right now.
I know.
No, thank you. That was a very good job, and I'm interested to see how this plays out. I remember this case. Yeah. I remember watching it on the news.
You're going to remember. That's what you'll remember about part 2 is that was when the manhunt was underway, and there was a carjacking, and there was a dramatic shootout.
But it's been 11 years.
That's right.
So I've forgotten a lot of the details, so I'm interested to hear those again next week. But I'm going to watch that movie before
Patriots Day.
Before Patriots Day,
And a lot of good documentaries on Netflix as well. All right, so folks, don't forget to go say something nice about the top 10 one of the top 10 true crime podcasts in the state of Alabama. Check us out on Facebook. You can see us on Instagram. We have a website of our very own that I maintain sometimes. I think I might need to go and see.
It's truecrimeoneasystreet.com.
Yep, that's right. So say something good about us on your podcast platform of choice and tune in next week for part 2 of this story. Anything else, guys? Is that it?
That's it.
Good night, everybody.